5. During the next 2 weeks, Maury Rock's predictions as to the decline of the Rosen electronic organ seemed to be borne out. All trucks reported few, if any, sales of organs. And we noticed that the Hammerstein people had begun to advertise one of their mood organs for less than $1,000. Of course, their price did not include shipping charges or the bench, but still, it was bad news for us. Meanwhile, the Stanton was in and out of our office. Maury had the idea of building a showroom for sidewalk traffic and having the Stanton demonstrate spinets. He got my permission to call in a contractor to remodel the ground floor of the building. The work began while the Stanton puttered about upstairs, helping Maury with the mail and hearing what it was going to have to do when the showroom had been completed. Maury advanced the suggestion that it shave off its beard, but after an argument between him and the Stanton, he withdrew his idea, and the Stanton went about as before, with its long white side whiskers. "Later on," Maury explained to me when the Stanton was not present, "I'm going to have it demonstrate itself. I'm in the process of finalizing on a sales pitch to that effect." He intended, he explained, to feed the pitch into the Stanton's ruling monad brain in the form of punched instruction tape. That way, there would be no arguments, as there had been over the whiskers. All this time, Maury was busy concocting a second simulacrum. It was in Massa's truck repair shop, on one of the workbenches, in the process of being assembled. On Thursday, the powers that decreed our new direction permitted me to view it for the first time. "Who's it going to be?" I asked, studying it with a feeling of gloom. It consisted of no more than a large complex of solenoids, wiring, circuit breakers, and the like, all mounted on aluminum panels. Bundy was busy testing a central monad turret. He had his voltmeter in the midst of the wiring, studying the reading on the dial. Maury said, "This is Abraham Lincoln." "You've lost control of your reason." "Not at all. I want something really big to take to Barrows when I visit him next month." "Oh, I see," I said. "You hadn't told me about that."
"You think I'm going to give up?"
"No," I admitted. "I knew you wouldn't give up. I know you."
"I've got the instinct," Maury said.
The next afternoon, after some gloomy pondering, I looked up Dr. Horstowski in the phone book. The office of Priss's outpatient psychiatrist was in the better residential section of Boise. I telephoned him and asked for an appointment as soon as possible.
"May I ask who recommended you?"
his nurse said. With distaste, I said, "Miss Priscilla Frauenzimmer."
"All right, Mr. Rosen. Dr. Horstowski can see you tomorrow at 1:30.
Technically, I was supposed to be out on the road again, setting up communities to receive our trucks. I was supposed to be making maps and inserting ads in newspapers, but ever since Maury's phone call to Sam Barrows, something had been the matter with me. Perhaps it had to do with my father, since the day he had set eyes on the Stanton and found out it was a machine built to resemble a man, he had become progressively more feeble. Instead of going down to the factory every morning, he often remained at home, generally hunched in a chair before the TV. The times I had seen him, he had a troubled expression, and his faculties seemed clouded. I mentioned it to Maury.
"Poor old guy," Maury said. "Louis, I hate to say this to you, but Jerome is getting frail."
"I realize that."
"He can't compete much longer."
"What do you suggest I do?"
"Keep him out of the bustle and strife of the marketplace. Consult with your mother and brother. Find out what Jerome has always wanted to do hobby-wise. Maybe carve flying model World War I airplanes, such as the Fokker triplane or the Spad. You should look into that, Louis, for the old man's sake. Am I right, buddy?"
I nodded.
"It's partly your fault," Maury said. "You haven't cared for him properly. When a man gets his age, he needs support. I don't mean financial. I mean spiritual."
The next day, I drove to Boise, and at 1:20, parked before the modern, architect-designed office building of Dr. Horstowski. When Dr. Horstowski appeared in the hallway to usher me into his office, I found myself facing a man built along the lines of an egg. His body was rounded, his head was rounded, he wore tiny round glasses. There were no straight or broken lines about him, and when he walked, he progressed in a flowing, smooth motion, as if he was rolling.
His voice, too, was soft and smooth. And yet, when I entered his office and seated myself and got a closer look, I saw that there was one feature of him which I had not noticed. He had a tough, harsh-looking nose, as flat and sharp as a parrot's beak. And now that I noticed that, I could hear in his voice a suppressed tearing edge of great harshness. He seated himself with a pad of lined paper and a pen, crossed his legs, and began to ask me dull, routine questions. "What did you wish to see me about?" he asked at last, in a voice barely at the fringe of audibility, but at the same time clearly distinct. "Well, I'm having this problem. I'm a partner in this firm, Massa Associates, and I feel that my partner and his daughter are against me and plotting behind my back. Especially, I feel they're out to degrade and destroy my family, in particular, my elderly father, Jerome, who isn't well enough or strong enough anymore to take that sort of thing."
"What sort of thing?"
"This deliberate and ruthless destruction of the Rosen Spinet and Electronic Organ Factory, and our entire retail system, in favor of a mad, grandiose scheme for saving mankind, or defeating the Russians, or something like that. I can't make out what it is, to be honest."
"Why can't you make it out?"
His pen scratched. "Because it changes from day to day." I paused. The pen paused, too. "It seems to be designed to reduce me to helplessness, and as a result, Maury will take over the business and maybe the factory as well. And they're mixed up with an incredibly wealthy and powerful, sinister figure, Sam K. Barrows of Seattle, whose picture you possibly saw on the cover of Look magazine." I was silent.
"Go on."
He enunciated as if he were a speech instructor. "Well, in addition, I feel that my partner's daughter, who is the prime mover in all this, is a dangerous ex-psychotic who can only be said to be as hard as iron and utterly without scruples." I looked at the doctor expectantly, but he said nothing and showed no visible reaction. "Pris Frauenzimmer," I said. He nodded. "What's your opinion?" I asked.
"Pris,"
Dr. Horstowski said, sticking his tongue out and down and staring at his notes,
"is a dynamic personality."
I waited, but that was all. "You think it's in my mind?" I demanded.
"What do you think is their motive for doing all this?"
he asked. That took me by surprise. "I don't know. Is it my business to figure that out? Hell, they want to peddle this simulacra to Barrows and make a mint. What else? And get a lot of prestige and power, I guess. They have maniacal dreams.
And you stand in their way."
"Right," I said.
"You have no such dreams."
"I'm a realist, or at least I try to be. As far as I'm concerned, that Stanton. Have you seen it?"
"Pris came in here once with it. It sat in the waiting room while she had her hour."
What did it do?"
"It read Life magazine."
"Didn't it make your blood crawl?" I asked.
"I don't think so."
"You weren't frightened to think that those two, Maury and Pris, could dream up something unnatural and dangerous like that?" Dr. Horstowski shrugged. "Christ," I said bitterly. "You're insulated. You're in here safe in this office. What do you care what goes on in the world?" Dr. Horstowski gave what seemed to me to be a fleeting but smug smile. That made me furious. "Doctor," I said, "I'll let you in on it. Pris is playing a cruel prank on you. She sent me in here. I'm a simulacrum, like the Stanton. I wasn't supposed to give the show away, but I can't go on with it any longer. I'm just the machine, made out of circuits and relay switches. You see how sinister all this is? She'd do it even to you. What do you say to that?" Halting in his writing, Dr. Horstowski said,
"Did you tell me you're married? If so, what is your wife's name, age, and does she have an occupation? And where born?"
"I'm not married. I used to have a girlfriend, an Italian girl who sang in a nightclub. She was tall and had dark hair. Her name was Lucretia, but she asked us to call her Mimi. Later on, she died of TB. That was after we split up. We used to fight. The doctor carefully wrote those facts down. "Aren't you going to answer my question?" I asked. It was hopeless. The doctor, if he had a reaction to the simulacrum sitting in his office reading life, was not going to reveal it. Or maybe he didn't have one. Maybe he didn't care who he found sitting across from him or among his magazines. Maybe he had taught himself long ago to accept anyone and anything he found there. But at least I could get an answer out of him regarding Pris, who I regarded as a worse evil than the simulacra. "I've got my .45 service revolver and shells," I said. "That's all I need. The opportunity will take care of itself. It's just a question of time before she tries the same cruelty on someone else as she did on me. I consider it my sacred task to rub her out. That's God's truth." Scrutinizing me, Horstowski said,
"Your real problem, as you phrased it, and I believe accurately, is the hostility you feel, a very mute and baffled hostility, seeking an outlet toward your partner and this 18-year-old girl who has difficulties of her own and who is actively seeking solutions in her own way as best she can."
Put like that, it did not sound so good. It was my own feelings which harried me, not the enemy. There was no enemy. There was only my own emotional life, suppressed and denied. "Well, what can you do for me?" I asked.
"I can't make your reality situation palatable to you, but I can help you comprehend it."
He opened a drawer of his desk. I saw boxes and bottles and envelopes of pills, a rat's nest of physician's samples, scattered and heaped. After rooting, Horstowski came up with a small bottle, which he opened.
"I can give you these. Take two a day, one when you get up and one on retiring. Chubrazine."
He passed me the bottle. "What's it do?" I put the bottle away in my inside pocket.
"I can explain it to you because you are professionally familiar with the mood organ. Cuprazine stimulates the anterior portion of the spetal region of the brain. Stimulation in that area, Mr. Rosen, will bring about greater alertness, plus cheerfulness, and a belief that events will work out all right on their own. It compares to this setting on the Hammerstein mood organ."
He passed me a small, glossy, folded, printed piece of paper. I saw Hammerstein's stop-setting indications on it.
"But the effect of the drug is much more intense, as you know. The amplitude of effect shock produced by the mood organ is severely limited by law."
I read the setting critically. By God, when translated into notes, it was close to the opening of the Beethoven 16th Quartet. What a vindication for enthusiasts of the Beethoven 3rd period, I said to myself. Just looked at, the stop-setting numbers made me feel better. "I can almost hum this drug," I said. "Want me to try?"
No, thank you. Now, you understand that if drug therapy does not avail in your case, we can always attempt brain slicing in the region of the temporal lobes, based, of course, on extensive brain mapping, which would have to be conducted at UC Hospital in San Francisco or Mount Zion. We have no facilities here. I prefer to avoid that myself if possible, since it often develops that the section of the temporal lobes involved can't be spared. The government has abandoned that at its clinics, you know."
"I'd rather not be sliced," I agreed. "I've had friends who've had that done, but personally it gives me the shivers. Let me ask you this. Do you by any chance have a drug whose setting in terms of the mood organ corresponds to portions of the choral movement of the Beethoven 9th?
"I've never looked into it," Horstowski said.
"On a mood organ, I'm particularly affected when I play the part where the choir sings, Muss ein lieber Vater wohnen. And then, very high up, like angels, the violins and the soprano part of the choir sing as an answer, Ubrem Sternenzelt."
"I'm not familiar with it to that extent,"
Horstowski admitted. "They're asking whether a heavenly father exists, and then very high up they answer yes, above the realm of stars. That part, if you could find the correspondence in terms of pharmacology, I might benefit enormously." Dr. Horstowski got out a massive loose-leaf binder and began to thumb through it.
I am afraid I can't locate a pill corresponding to that. You might consult with the Hammerstein engineers, however.
Good idea, I said.
Now, as to your dealings with Pris, I think you are a little strong in your view of her as a menace. After all, you are free not to associate with her at all, aren't you?
He eyed me slyly. I guess so.
Pris has challenged you. She's a provocative personality. Most people who know her, I'd imagine, get to feeling as you do. That's Pris's way of stirring them up, making them react. It is probably allied to her scientific bent. It's a form of curiosity. She wants to see what makes people tick.
He smiled. In this case, I said, she almost killed the specimen while trying to investigate it.
Pardon?
He cupped his ear.
Yes, a specimen. She perceives other people sometimes in that aspect. But I wouldn't let that throw me. We live in a society where detachment is almost essential.
While he was saying this, Dr. Horstowski was writing in his appointment book.
What do you think of, he murmured, when you think of Pris?
Milk, I said.
Milk?
His eyes opened wide.
Interesting. Milk.
I'm not coming back here, I told him. It's no use giving me that card. However, I accepted the appointment card. Our time is up for today, is it?
Regrettably, Dr. Horstowski said, it is.
I was not kidding when I told you I'm one of Pris's simulacra. There used to be a Louis Rosen, but no more. Now there's only me. And if anything happens to me, Pris and Maury have the instructional tapes to create another. Pris makes the body out of bathroom tile. It's pretty good, isn't it? It fooled you and my brother Chester and almost my father. That's the actual reason he's so unhappy. He guessed the truth. Having said that, I nodded goodbye and walked from the office, along the hall and through the waiting room to the street. But you, I said to myself, you'll never guess, Dr. Horstowski, not in a million years. I'm good enough to fool you and all the rest of them like you. Getting into my Chevrolet Magic Fire, I drove slowly back to the office.